A Canaanite tribe deceives Israel. This chapter is based on Joshua 9 and 10. From Shechem, the Israelites returned to their camp at Gilgal. Here, a strange delegation visited them, claiming that they had come from a distant country. This seemed to be confirmed by the way they looked. Their clothing was old and worn, their sandals patched, their food moldy, and the skins that they used for wine bottles were torn and patched, as if hastily repaired on the journey. In their far-off home, supposedly a long way from Palestine, they had heard of the wonders that God had performed and had sent to make a treaty with Israel. The Hebrews had been specially warned against entering into any treaty with the idolaters of Canaan, and a doubt arose in the minds of the leaders about the truth of the strangers' words. "Perhaps you dwell among us," they said. To this, the ambassadors replied, "We are your servants." But when Joshua directly demanded of them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" they added, "This bread of ours we took hot for our provision from our houses on the day we departed to come to you. But now, look, it is dry and moldy. And these wineskins which we filled were new, and see, they are torn. And these, our garments and our sandals, have become old because of the very long journey." The Hebrews did not ask counsel of the Lord. So Joshua made peace with them, and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the rulers of the congregation swore to them. So the treaty was ratified. 3 days afterward, Israel discovered the truth. They heard that they were their neighbors who dwelt near them. The Gibeonites had turned to trickery in order to preserve their lives. The Israelites became more displeased when, after 3 days' journey, they reached the cities of the Gibeonites near the center of the land. But the princes refused to break the treaty, even though it was gained by deceit, because they had sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel. The children of Israel did not attack them. The Gibeonites had pledged themselves to give up idolatry and accept the worship of Jehovah, and preserving their lives was not a violation of God's command to destroy the idolatrous Canaanites. Although the oath had been secured by deception, it was not to be ignored. No consideration of reward, of revenge, or self-interest can in any way change the binding nature of an oath or pledge. "He that may ascend into the hill of the Lord and stand in his holy place is he who swears to his own hurt and does not change." Psalm 24, verse 3. 15, 4. How the Gibeonites made themselves slaves. The Gibeonites were permitted to live, but were assigned to the sanctuary as slaves to perform unskilled services. That day Joshua made them woodcutters and water carriers for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord. These conditions they gratefully accepted, glad to purchase life on any terms. "Here we are, in your hands," they said to Joshua. "Do with us as it seems good and right to do to us." Gibeon, the most important of their towns, was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and all its men were mighty. It is a striking evidence of the terror with which the Israelites had filled the inhabitants of Canaan that the people of a powerful city would resort to such a humiliating way to save their lives. But the Gibeonites would have been better off if they had dealt honestly with Israel. Their deception only brought them disgrace and slavery. God had made a way so that everyone who would give up heathenism and connect with Israel would share the blessings of the covenant. With few exceptions, such people were to enjoy equal favors and privileges with Israel. The Gibeonites could have been received on these terms. It was a major humiliation to those citizens of a royal city, of which all its men were mighty, to be made woodcutters and water carriers. And so, through all their generations, their servile condition would testify that God hates falsehood. Joshua's Long Day. The surrender of Gibeon to Israel filled the kings of Canaan with dismay. They took immediate steps for revenge on those who had made peace with the invaders. Five of the Canaanite kings allied themselves against Gibeon. The Gibeonites were unprepared for defense and sent a message to Joshua at Gilgal. "Do not forsake your servants. Come up to us quickly, save us, and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the mountains have gathered together against us." The danger threatened not only the people of Gibeon, but also Israel. This city controlled the passes to central and southern Palestine, and Israel must hold it in order to conquer the country. The overwhelmed Gibeonites were afraid that Joshua would reject their request for help because of the way they had deceived the Israelites. But since they had submitted to Israel and had accepted the worship of God, he felt obligated to protect them. And the Lord encouraged him. "Do not fear them," was the divine message, "for I have delivered them into your hand. Not a man of them shall stand before you." So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. The allied princes had just positioned their armies around the city when Joshua was upon them. The immense host fled from the Hebrews up the mountain pass to Beth Horon, and from the top they rushed down the steep descent on the other side, where a fierce hailstorm burst upon them. The Lord cast down large hailstones from heaven. There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword. While the Amorites were fleeing in panic, Joshua looked down from the ridge above and saw that the day would be too short to finish his work. If not fully defeated, their enemies would fight them again. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord, and he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. The sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. Before evening came, God's promise to Joshua had been fulfilled. The enemy had been given into his hand. The events of that day would remain in the memory of Israel for a long time. There has been no day like that, before it or after it, that the Lord heeded the voice of a man. For the Lord fought for Israel. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of your arrows they went, at the shining of your glittering spear. You marched through the land in indignation. You trampled the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people. Habakkuk 3, verse 11 to 13. Joshua had received the promise that God would overthrow these enemies of Israel, yet he put as much effort into it as though success depended on the armies of Israel alone. He did all that human energy could do, and then he called out in faith for divine aid. The secret of success is the blending of divine power with human effort. The man who commanded, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon," is the man who lay flat on the earth for hours in prayer at Gilgal. People of prayer are people of power. This mighty miracle shows that the creation is under the control of the Creator. In this miracle, all who put nature above the God of nature are rebuked. At his own will, God gathers the forces of nature to overthrow the strength of his enemies: fire and hail, snow and clouds, stormy wind, fulfilling his word. Psalm 148, verse 8. We are told of a greater battle to take place in the closing scenes of Earth's history, when the Lord has opened his armory and has brought out the weapons of his indignation. Jeremiah 50, verse 25. John, who wrote the book of Revelation, describes the destruction that is to take place when the loud voice out of the temple of heaven announces, "It is done." He says, "Great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of a talent. Revelation 16, verse 17, 21.